I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The people of the Red Lake Band of the Chippewa Indians are reeling today after a 17-year-old tribe member went on a shooting rampage in Bemidji, Minnesota. Jeff Weiss killed 10 people, including himself and his grandfather, who's also the tribe's chief. Larry Oakes is a reporter for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Larry, first of all, where are you?
I'm outside the hospital in Bemidji, Minnesota.
Can you just, for those who haven't heard this horrendous story yet, just briefly tell us what happened?
Between 2:30 and 3 yesterday afternoon, a 17-year-old student shot and killed his grandparents and then apparently took his grandfather's squad car. His grandfather was a police officer, and possibly his grandfather's guns, and drove to his school and shot a security guard, shot his way into the school, shot a teacher, and then shot five students.
There were many witnesses to this who survived. Did he say anything while he was shooting?
He may have said hello or waved to some students he knew. There are also reports that he smiled at some students, but most of what students recount seeing and hearing is just a lot of chaos, a lot of gunfire.
There are a lot of reports floating around, Larry. What do we know about Jeff Weiss?
We don't know a whole lot of confirmed things at this point. There's various sources and various people have been saying that he showed some signs of being depressed and disturbed in the recent past, that he had a tough life, that his dad may have committed suicide, that he had been showing kind of a fascination with the dark side lately, with Gothic culture, possibly with neo-Nazi websites and neo-Nazi groups, that he had told friends it would be cool to shoot people and maybe even shoot up the school, that he was listening to a lot of really raunchy, hard, heavy metal music.
In fact, web searches show the name Jeff Weiss of Red Lake on a website called Nazi.org, and he might have gone by the internet name of Native Nazi.
He may have. I don't have independent knowledge of that.
Has been confirmed. How is this impacting the tribe on the reservation?
Well, everyone, not just the tribe, but their neighbors here throughout northern Minnesota are just shocked and reeling. You know, they all knew about Columbine, and we've been hearing that word a lot in the last day, that this is another Columbine. It's just about as bad. And people are having a hard time believing that that kind of horror has been visited on their backyard.
Larry Oakes, a reporter for the Minneapolis Star Tribune, speaking to us from outside the North Country Regional Hospital in Bemidji, Minnesota. Larry, thank you.
Thank you.
And we turn now to Carla Panko. She's manager of the Trading Post on the Red Lake Reservation. Carla, first of all, did you know Jeff Weiss?
No, I didn't.
From the accounts that we read, he was considered a loner, but also it was well known that he was a supporter of Hitler. He claims to have been talked to by authorities about plans to shoot up the school on Hitler's birthday. Had you known anything of that?
I had not heard anything about it before yesterday. My daughter, who is about the same age, later said that she had heard some things just from through friends of friends, things yeah. like that, and but nobody, you know, noticed anything, you know, forthcoming.
Well, how are people reacting today?
It's pretty somber around here. You know, people are just still trying to figure out, you know, why this happened. It's kind of confusing, I guess, for everybody.
Yeah.
And just everybody around here is affected by it because it is a small community. In one way or another, you know.
How about his family? What do you know? What did you know about his grandfather who was shot and killed?
His grandfather is a veteran police officer, very nice person, very well-liked in the community, just a very kind person.
You said it was a small town.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, I mean, people, there must be connections. Everybody must have a connection to someone
mm-hmm.
who was shot. Did you?
Yes, actually I did. My sister's nephew on her husband's side had a nephew that was shot along with my nephew was along with him. Mm-hmm. And luckily he made it out, where the other one wasn't quite so lucky, but he is doing good now. He went through surgery last night.
He was injured. Is the school closed today, do you know?
Yes, it will probably so far close the rest of the week. From there, I don't really know. Most of the businesses and things are closed around here.
Really?
The reservation is closed to anybody. No one is allowed on the reservation right now.
So what are people saying to you today?
They just talk about, you know, about how everybody's doing, how unbelievable this is. You know, it's still sinking in with people. And everybody is just trying to get through this right now and just be there for each other.
Well, Carla, thanks so much. You've really helped us, you know, paint a picture that we couldn't see from here. So thank you. Thank you so much.
Yep.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Carla Panko runs the Trading Post on the Red Lake Reservation in Minnesota. And now to the case of Terry Schiavo. Today, her parents filed a notice of appeal after a federal judge in Florida refused to order the reinsertion of their daughter's feeding tube, a move seen by many lawmakers and conservative groups, such as the Family Research Council, as a human rights violation. They say she's being starved to death and that it's torture and agony. But is it? Here now is Fred Tice, visited two teaching hospitals in Boston and began by speaking with Dr. Susan Block of the Dana-Farber Institute, Cancer Institute, rather, and Brigham and Women's Hospital. He asked Dr. Block about what happens when terminally ill patients find themselves in intensive care and nearing death.
I think the important thing to recognize is that in the United States now, about 80 to 95% of patients dying in intensive care units die through active decisions on the part of the patient, family, and physicians to either withhold or withdraw medical treatments. So patients in intensive care units almost never die without an active decision and choice about the timing of death through withholding or withdrawing treatment. So I think that's the key contextual point that's really important to grapple with here. And it has to do with the fact that we have these technologies which are capable of sustaining life, often for very long periods of time, even when a person is suffering or unaware or in a state of irreversible terminal illness.
Dr. Lachlan Farrow is director of ethics programs at the Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. He also directs the hospital's end-of-life programs. He says when feeding tubes are removed, patients feel no pain.
Well, in the case of patients like Terry Schiavo, where multiple specialists have confirmed that she is unconscious, has no sensation, it is not physically possible for them to suffer from anything, including from hunger or from thirst. So in a case like that, the answer is no. There's no suffering of any kind, including no possible suffering from stopping feeding or fluids. In the case of people who are conscious, the best information experience that we have from hundreds and hundreds of patients who themselves have decided at a stage of advanced illness that they don't want longer life through fluids and nutrition. They voluntarily say, I'm not going to take any more of this. They don't show signs of discomfort. So there's very little reason to believe that for severely ill or unconscious patients, stopping nutrition or stopping fluids causes discomfort.
Dr. Block at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute agrees.
The removal of the tube is usually not painful to somebody. They may feel some sensation if they're aware, but usually the tube removal is not painful. Most of what we know about patients' experiences having food or fluids withdrawn or stopped really comes from patients who are awake and aware and can communicate to us about their experience, obviously. And what we understand from patients with terminal illnesses who on occasion elect this choice as a way of, in some sense, hastening their death, usually they don't feel a sense of hunger. Because bodies shut down at that point in advanced terminal illness and don't have the same hunger mechanism that might be present in a person who is healthy. They don't have the same thirst mechanism as would usually be present in someone who's healthy. So that the experiences of hunger and thirst are not a big part of the picture, or even usually a small part of the picture, for patients who are terminally ill and who make decisions to stop eating and drinking.
Dr. Block says the most important thing people can do is to talk to their families about what their wishes would be should they become unable.
A number of years ago, my dad had to undergo a very risky spinal cord surgery that had left him with a very high probability, 15 or 25%, that he would be quadriplegic at a very high level, which would mean that he'd be really completely paralyzed. And before his surgery, he and I had a number of very painful, very difficult conversations about what his wishes would be under that situation. And he wanted to make very sure that I understood his wishes were, because he knew that we would probably make some different choices about things, and was very clear about if he were alive and could eat chocolate ice cream and watch football on TV, that would be okay with him. And I had a pretty good sense from him after this very difficult, unpleasant, awful conversation about what his wishes were. And he went on to have the surgery and had a significant complication where he was unable to speak for himself. And there had to be a decision, an immediate decision, about whether he would go back into the operating room for another major surgery that would make him even more likely to be quadriplegic. And what I realized at that point, it was a very crucial learning moment for me, was that my dad had already made the decision about what he wanted, and I was just giving voice to it, and that I didn't have to decide on his behalf, that he'd already decided, made it clear to me, and I was just passing it on to the doctors. And what I learned from that was that having these conversations in advance relieves an incredible burden on family members, because I would have torn myself up about this situation, about was I making the right decision, should we do this, should we not do this. I would have, if we had not gone ahead with the surgery and he died, I would have tortured myself about whether I in some way contributed to his death. If we had gone ahead with it and he'd lived and become quadriplegic, I would have tortured myself about that decision. And it was very helpful to have had this kind of conversation before he became incapacitated.
In this case, presumably he would have wanted you to go ahead with a second operation, right?
Right. It was absolutely clear cut. I didn't have to, you know, think. I had to make the decision within minutes, and I knew instantly what he wanted.
What was the outcome?
He actually ended up going through the surgery and having a very long, difficult recuperation, but did much better than anybody expected and didn't end up being quadriplegic, and is, you know, alive and doing pretty well today. So it was a good outcome.
That was Dr. Susan Block of the Harvard Medical School speaking with Here Now's Fred Tice. Earlier we heard from Dr. Lachlan Farrow, Director of Ethics at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, also in Boston. Well, when we come back, Congress intervened in the Terry Schiavo case. How will that affect decisions doctors have to make in the future? Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, letting doctors weigh in on the Terry Schiavo case. First, a brief summary of the news. The parents of the brain-damaged Florida woman have filed an emergency appeal following a ruling from a federal judge. This morning, the judge refused to order Schiavo's feeding tube reinserted. Schiavo is in what doctors have called a persistent vegetative state. And we'll have more in a moment on the medical questions surrounding the case. But first, we spoke with Dr. John Kaluz from the University of Miami School of Medicine. He's a pediatrician who's an expert on brain injuries. Now, Congress ordered the case to the federal courts, and Dr. Kaluz has a strong opinion on how that intervention will affect future decisions doctors have to make.
Right now, we will quite readily put in these feeding tubes and do the heroic measures, even in patients who we think only have a 5 or 10% chance of recovering. You know, knowing that families with a severely vegetative patient can oftentimes be destroyed, you know, financially and emotionally, we will give the patient the benefit of the doubt and place feeding tubes and be very aggressive with the idea that we would do this level of support for a period of time until a patient reaches their maximum state of recovery. And if that maximum plateau is a vegetative state, then most people in the medical community would agree that it's time to, that's not a quality of life, that when families want to let that type of family member die, then it's very appropriate to do that, and we would be in favor of that. So if we are then going to be limited down the road as to what our options are, then we may be, many doctors would be very reluctant to give the patient the benefit of the doubt and put these types of life-sustaining interventions in place.
Dr. John Kaluz is a pediatrician at the University of Miami Schools of Medicine. Well, as doctors and families struggle with decision-making, the science of brain injuries is evolving. Doctors know that how a brain injury happens and how long it takes a patient to emerge from a coma are significant. Brain injuries caused by heart attacks, for example, are often worse than those sustained in car accidents, and being in a persistent vegetative state for several months is much different than being in one for over 15 years. Doctors are also researching a newly defined category of mental awareness called a minimally conscious state, in which patients show some brain function. Well, joining us on the line is Dr. Nicholas Schiff. He's an expert on minimally conscious states. He's an assistant professor of neurology at Weill Cornell Medical Center in New York. And Dr. Schiff, I wanted to start with some definitions on the mental states of brain-injured patients, but I understand that's not how doctors start with a diagnosis.
That's right. We don't start by just identifying the functional level of someone's exam and just, well, they're in a coma, they're in a vegetative state, they're in a minimally conscious state. What we are concerned about first is what happened to them. What is the nature of their illness? And that's much more determining of outcome, of prognosis, of other things than the particular functional level at a particular time.
How does a persistent vegetative state differ from a coma?
A coma is a state of unarousable unresponsiveness. Coma is usually a transient state that gives way to further recovery. The recovery may be nothing other than the brainstem recovering the ability to open the eyes and close the eyes on some sort of a regular schedule. Vegetative states arise usually following a coma, and what's happening is the patient is starting to recover some patterning of arousal responses, which are irregular appearance of the eyes closed, sleep-like state, in an eyes-open state in which the person is nonetheless unresponsive, shows
right.
No evidence of awareness of themselves or their environment. The minimally conscious state is also a state that can arise in the phase of recovery and can show as little as the ability to reliably sustain fixation and track objects, although there's been some debate in the literature as to whether that should be enough to get you out of the vegetative state diagnostically. On the upper boundary of the minimally conscious state are patients who look completely different at the bedside, who, to anybody's eye, clearly are following commands and almost able to interact, but nonetheless cannot communicate. These are very different things.
And here we have Terry Schiavo, 15 years out. First of all, is there any chance that she's been misdiagnosed, that she's in a minimally conscious state as opposed to a persistent vegetative state, in your mind?
I wouldn't think so, no. I mean, I don't see, there are very clear, you know, statements from professionals who are well qualified and very experienced who were involved in this case. I wasn't involved, but mm-hmm. I know of the people who were involved, and that's the diagnosis they came to, and it would be a very big surprise to me that they wouldn't have made the diagnosis accurately.
Then why, doctor, do you suspect, and again, you have not treated Terry Schiavo, but why would her parents and siblings say that they think she has tracked a ball across the room and other things that define the minimally conscious state?
Well, I don't know. The bigger issue I have is whether the physicians who are telling anybody, and I think they're raising false hope when they do this in a way that's really not fair, that patients 15 years out from a cardiac arrest have the capacity to make further gains. I'd like to know what they were proposing and what evidentiary basis they would have for that.
But you know, we've been conditioned, the layperson has been conditioned to say if somebody's eyes have opened, that's a good thing. That's what you hear in news reports about coma patients.
It's true.
And it's not necessarily true of somebody in a persistent vegetative state.
Right. It's not right. It's not so simple.
Which is why this is so hard.
It's not so simple. And, you know, I think we're, I mean, the bottom line is we're not going to have a rational dialogue on this unless people become much better educated than they are. And I don't really think that it's impossible for the lay public to become better educated, but they do have to, they have to go with the idea that, you know, science is going to help us sort out who we can and can't help, and that we are missing people who we should be able to try and help, and we're not. But we can't, you know, we can't conflate everything. We can't make everything the same thing.
Dr. Nicholas Schiff is assistant professor of neurology at Weill Cornell Medical Center in New York. And the case goes on. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And as we speak, and as high school students wait anxiously, the SATs are being graded, with test scores pouring over the new essay portion of the test. But what if you could replace some of those professional readers with computers? The Educational Testing Service has developed an e-rater, a system they say does just that, not on the SATs, but on over 2 million state high school essays, as well as the GMAT, the standard test that students take when they apply for business school. Well, joining us on the line from ETS in New Jersey is Jill Burstein. She's principal development scientist and one of the inventors of E-Rater. Jill, welcome.
Thank you.
And I have to say, I'm one of those who says, huh? How does this work? Let's start with, how does it work?
E-Rater takes as input a sample of essays which have been scored by teachers, and it evaluates the essays using sort of a linguistic analysis. So it analyzes them for sentence structure, for discourse structure, for word use, and combining all of these features and using statistical methods to arrive at a score.
Can you give me an example of some of the things the E-Rater has picked up? Is there a way to give us examples of sentences or misplaced commas or something?
E-Rater is giving a score in the end. It's combining a whole bunch of features and coming up with a numerical value. Within Criterion, which is the online essay scoring application that we have something called the Writing Analysis Tools, and it's here that you can actually see the different kinds of grammar errors, usage errors. So, for instance, one of the things that we picked up, if you've made a mistake with homophones, so there, there, and there, did you use T-H-E-I-R versus T-H-E-R-E?
But how can a computer judge heart and cleverness and deep thinking?
E-Rater is not judging art and cleverness. E-Rater is designed to score the kinds of essays that students take on standardized tests. Typically, they don't introduce irony or metaphor or any of these literary mechanisms into their essay. They're trying to answer a question very clearly. They're usually trying to write something like a persuasive essay or an expository essay. And it's not, we try to make the distinction between standardized test essays and literary essays.
Well, but it should still make sense. And I'm sure you're aware of the reporter for the Dayton Daily News who says that he wrote an essay on his banana-eating purple imaginary friend. He said it was just gibberish, you know. And that essay got a better score using this testing than an on-topic essay that he said he put a lot of serious effort into.
A lot of people do try to fool the system, and it is a computer. We try to design filters to deal with what we call the torpedoers, the people who try and come in and fool the system. But basically, the design goes like this. If you write a good faith essay and you try to answer the question, the computer will give you a score similar or exactly to what a human reader would give you. And the evidence that we have to back that up is that after having scored millions and millions of essays, especially for the GMAT, GMAT has a human in the loop. So there's always a reader, a human reader, and there's a machine score. And E-Rater and the human agree exactly or within 1 point, which is the criterion for agreement in standardized, when you're scoring standardized tests.
Do you ever see a computer testing system that can sort of sit back and decide whether or not it likes an essay?
What would it do if it liked an essay?
I don't know. I mean, you know, they could grade.
Surprised by
right, they could say, "Wow, this is a great plot line," or, you know, "Oh, I'm surprised at that twist," or, you know, they could have some sort of emotional reaction to emotional content of an essay.
I think some people are working on looking at metaphor. For instance, we're working on looking more intensively at logical connections that appear in writing, and maybe introducing that into the system. But that's further off than what we've been able to do so far,
yeah.
But it's an ongoing, evolving product.
Right. Well, Jill Burstein, Principal Development Scientist with the Educational Testing Service, they've come up with E-Rater, which allows computers to grade essays. Jill, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Well, regardless of how you grade the writing, common wisdom says high school students can't write. They can instant message on the internet, text message on their cell phones, but they can't complete a sentence. Well, that sentiment makes some educators LOL. That's laugh out loud to the online set. And here to tell us more is Christian Science Monitor reporter Christina McCarroll. Welcome.
Thank you.
Now, this doesn't make any sense to me. Did it make sense to you when you first heard this, that there was a possibility that kids were actually writing better?
It surprised me when educators and teachers began telling me that. I had expected people to mostly to be saying the opposite.
How are they measuring that?
Well, a bunch of the people that I talked to were people who helped grade the essay portion of standardized tests, such as the SAT-1s or the SAT-2s, which used to be known as the achievement tests. Other people who I talked to, it was more of an anecdotal thing. Classroom teachers who had been teaching for, you know, 20, 30, 40 years and had just noticed their students becoming consistently better writers over the years.
Because even though they may be using those phrases, "Are you there?" with just the R is one that pops up a lot on emails, they're actually engaged more in writing.
They're engaged, and they're practicing expressing themselves in words, practicing flowing between ideas and corresponding in a way that people haven't been, some said at least, that people haven't been in decades. One person I spoke with was talking about the decline of the print culture, and I hear that phrase tossed around a lot now, too, but what he was talking about was actually the decline of the print and literary culture that went along with the proliferation of TV sets and telephones into American homes, and that with people, you know, so constantly expressing themselves, either sitting in front of the TV or just talking on the phone, and writing many fewer letters than before, that was when he really saw a literary culture declining in America. And he said now, with the rise of the computer and the rise of all these various means of electronic communication, that we were getting that back to some degree.
You're talking about a conversation you have with Alan Filreese. He's director of the Kelly Writers House at the University of Pennsylvania. But we understand you also got some feedback on student writing from your mom?
My mom teaches 8th grade English, and at one point last year, she was having her students do an assignment in which they kind of wrote a letter to their future selves about them as 8th graders, and then she would keep the letters in sealed envelopes and send them back to the kids 4 years from now.
What a great idea, by the way.
She's a good teacher. So she had the kids write these letters and realized, to her surprise and also to her horror, that they had no idea how to write letters, not only in terms of the letters themselves and, you know, say, with the salutation and the body of the letter and the signature, but even to the degree of addressing envelopes. They had no idea, you know, where the stamp went, what information you needed on there in terms of name and address and city, and what order in which it should go.
So there are still some perhaps concerns, but the fact is they have been writing to each other without envelopes.
Right. They probably know how to address their emails a lot better than some grown-ups right. do.
And express their feelings either
yes,
way.
So.
Christina McCarroll, staff reporter for the Christian Science Monitor, who's written about the surprising discovery by many educators that teenagers are actually writing more and better because they use their computers and emails and such. Christina, thank you.
Thank you.
And speaking of writing, still to come, an ancient story of dragon slaying and self-discovery gets a modern retelling. You're listening to Here and Now. Time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts. After our visit to Tech Boston Academy, a small pilot public school that's partly funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and has high standards and gets great test results, Dan Wenlies of Philadelphia wrote to say, "While I found your report to be fair and balanced on the whole, it didn't emphasize enough for me the connection between school success and selectivity of the student body. Now, while Tech Boston doesn't select students, students and parents do get to choose Tech Boston, and therefore they're more committed to it than students and parents in urban neighborhood public schools with no other choice. Now, I'm not trying to take away anything from Tech Boston. What they do is great. However, there are many in the media and politics who view this type of school success as independent of the student body. The next logical step for them is to say the problem in America's schools is the bureaucracy, the administration, the teachers. If we could only turn schools over to private companies, then we could solve the whole problem." Well, if you really want to identify a successful school, then you should find an urban public school that serves all kids, including those who don't want to learn. Then you truly have a success story. Dick Tucker and others also wrote to question our use of the word euthanasia to describe the removal of Terri Schiavo's feeding tube. Dick writes, "Euthanasia is not the same as allowing natural death, which is the issue in the Schiavo case. Euthanasia is inflammatory when used in this discussion, and in my opinion, it clouds the issue." Well, we decided to call Dr. Michael Grodin, an ethicist at Boston University's Schools of Medicine and Public Health.
Well, euthanasia, it comes from the Greek good death. And classically, what makes it a good death is it means somebody who dies, who's terminally, irreversibly ill, and in pain and suffering. And therefore, there's no other alternative, but they're in the process of dying, and they're in pain and suffering. And therefore, the good death is allowing the person to die. Then it can be divided up into active versus passive. Active would be actually killing somebody who's terminally or irreversibly ill and in pain and suffering. Passive would be discontinuing life support and allowing somebody to die who's terminally or irreversibly ill and in pain and suffering.
Well, and Terri Schiavo is having her life support removed, the feeding tube. So is her case euthanasia?
Well, classically, it wouldn't be. First of all, she's not in any pain and suffering. And secondly, as long as she's on the feeding tube, she's not terminally ill. So classically, it'd be somebody with cancer, an end-stage disease that, in spite of treatment, is going to be terminally ill and in the process of dying. The other thing that comes up that I teach in my ethics classes is three terms: intentionality, predictability, and causation. So we, in order to hold people accountable, we usually like to say that there's an intent, meaning the intent is to die, that it's predictable, meaning that whatever you do is going to end in the death, and that there's a direct causal relationship in time and space between the action and the ultimate death.
But all of those three do apply to Terri Schiavo.
Well, that's why the people who ever do it are responsible. I'm just saying that means that there's responsibility. That doesn't mean it's necessarily euthanasia.
Right, because in her case, as you said, she does not necessarily have a terminal illness. She's in sort of this limbo.
But she could be there for 30 years, yeah.
Doctor, thank you.
Okay.
Recently, Here and Now's culture critic Bill Marx interviewed best-selling horror novelist Peter Straub about the collected works of H.P. Lovecraft. Straub edited the collection for the Library of America. He was a fan. Bill Marx was not. Bill said Lovecraft's horror tales were written in popular magazines aimed at teenage boys and influenced many of today's slasher films. Todd Mason wrote to disagree. He says Lovecraft's writing wasn't aimed at gender or age as much as those seeking well-written to utterly purple horror, fantasy, and related fiction. His fans famously ranged from the young Tennessee Williams to Ray Bradbury, and the magazine he wrote in was consistently cited in Best American Short Stories throughout its first run of publication from 1923 to 54. And any attempt to blame slasher movies on Lovecraft, as Marx does, is, as Straub suggests, lunatic. Lovecraft does indeed go on about unspeakable horrors in some of his fiction, and he indeed then goes on to leave their description at that, in wan hope that you will provide your own appropriate imagery. This has nothing to do with the utterly explicit slaughter of modern film, unless the latter is seen as a sort of rebellion against the restraint Lovecraft typified. As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. But please, remember to include your full name, phone number, and town. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Long before Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, King Gilgamesh and his friend Enkidu set out in Uruk, now Iraq, on a journey of dragon slaying and self-discovery. In fact, their story was told over 5,000 years ago, 1,000 years before the Bible. Recently, Gilgamesh had a new retelling from acclaimed poet and translator Stephen Mitchell.
He had seen everything, had experienced all emotions, from exaltation to despair, had been granted a vision into the great mystery, the secret places, the primeval days before the flood. He had journeyed to the edge of the world and made his way back, exhausted but whole.
Gilgamesh is a tale that foreshadows Homer's Odyssey, the Hebrews' Noah, and according to Stephen Mitchell, current events in Iraq. His book is called Gilgamesh, A New English Version, and when he visited our studio last fall, he reminded us first of the story behind Gilgamesh and his friend Enkidu.
It's about a king who's a gigantic, powerful presence who becomes a tyrant.
Gilgamesh the king, his friend Enkidu, a naked wild man civilized through the erotic arts of a temple priestess.
That's a marvelous episode. It's so deeply moving and interesting to encounter a culture which has Eros at its center, and in a totally positive way, it sees making love as a civilizing virtue. The rest of the book is about friendship and arrogance and preemptive attacks and the unforeseen consequences, and then about death and grief and how that grief leads Gilgamesh into a quest for immortality and ultimately wisdom.
Mm. Gilgamesh and Enkidu set off on the mother of all heroic journeys. They're going to attack the monster Humbaba in the cedar forest. And you say that's the original preemptive attack.
Well, it is. Gilgamesh decides to attack the monster for no discernible reason except that he wants to win fame, and for the best of motives, he wants to rid the world of evil. The monster has been put in his position by the gods, and his job is to terrify human beings away from the cedar forest. The gods don't want human beings cutting down the great cedars.
It's the original ecological balance.
It is, and we could use a few monsters in our national forests, I think. There's a lot of sympathy for the monster. And after he's killed, the consequences are that that Gilgamesh's dear, intimate friend and lover, Enkidu, has to pay the price and has
lover?
To die.
Is this a
well? This is the first and probably the only great masterpiece that includes gay marriage. Their relationship is extremely intimate. It's the great example in our cultural heritage of a lasting sexual relationship between two men. This, you have to understand, is 1,000 years before David and Jonathan in the Bible and Achilles and Patroclus in the Iliad.
Mm. Well, you have just brought up a whole bunch of things, and I'm wondering, you know, for people who are saying, wow, I read Gilgamesh in 10th grade and I don't remember any of that. Is this something you're seeing in the translations? Is this
No, it's explicit. When Enkidu dies, he mourns him as a bride, and he sets out on a journey to try to find a way to avoid death. He's heard that his ancestor, has been granted immortality by the gods. This is the Noah figure in this story. It's a story of the great flood and of a man being instructed to build an ark. This, again, is 1,000 years before the Bible. Ultimately, Gilgamesh travels to the ends of the world and goes through some wonderful adventures and finally meets this man who recounts the story of the great flood and basically says, this was a one-time deal and it's too bad it's not available to you. And Gilgamesh has to deal with that. And in dealing with that and seeing that the quest for wisdom has its own, is deconstructed in the doing, he arrives at a mature kind of wisdom.
So we shouldn't be saying someone goes on a Homeric journey. We should be saying they go on a Gilgameshian journey. Stephen Mitchell, you've said you see comparisons to modern-day Iraq. Do you worry mm-hmm. about bringing your modern-day sensibilities to something so ancient?
I don't. When I'm translating a great classic, it's always a question of the sounds of the words and of the rhythm. I don't know Akkadian, which is a form of ancient Babylonian, so I worked with half a dozen literal scholarly translations into English and then a number of others into German and French, and did all my homework, read all the scholarship, and there's some excellent scholarship, and then put together a literal version. And that was about 10% of my work. The other 90% was taking that basic literal version and raising it to the level of a verse in English and finding a music that seemed genuine and as exciting and powerful as the story itself is. The story is riveting in any version. You can read it in a child's version and see the power of it. But I had felt in reading many, many translations that the language had never matched the excitement and power of the story, and that's why I began to do it myself. You have to be a bit blind and deaf if you're writing in 2004 about a masterpiece that comes from ancient Iraq, for goodness sake, and is about somebody going out to kill a monster, for goodness sake, not to see the parallel. So right. I think it would have been silly for me not to point them out. They exist.
What do you make of that, that they do exist?
Well, I think that when a writer is writing from the depth that any writer of a masterpiece is necessarily writing from, they're tapping into a level of human experience and wisdom that makes the masterpiece relevant for any age.
And in the final analysis, Gilgamesh could not have become the good man he became if he hadn't gone to foolishly and arrogantly attack the dragon that wasn't harming him.
The
monster. And if he hadn't lost his best friend.
That's true. And it takes a good deal of humility and grief to come to that wisdom. If you're not aware that you've made a grave mistake, then the path is not to wisdom but to further disasters.
Poet Stephen Mitchell, author of Gilgamesh, A New English Version, will leave you with the end of the prologue, inviting the reader in to the city where Gilgamesh lived and to one of the greatest stories ever told.
Walk on the wall of Uruk, follow its course around the city, inspect its mighty foundations, examine its brickwork, how masterfully it is built. Observe the land it encloses, the palm trees, the gardens, the orchards, the glorious palaces and temples, the shops and marketplaces, the houses, the public squares. Find the cornerstone, and under it the copper box that is marked with his name. Unlock it. Open the lid. Take out the tablet of lapis lazuli. Read how Gilgamesh suffered all and accomplished all.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.